The Saturday panel on OTB.
And I'm coming off the pitch. He said, Richard is on the phone. Richard? Yeah, he said, he's in Mexico. And then I'm totally bamboozled. I said, who the hell is Richard in Mexico? But it happened to be Richard Harris. But I got on the phone to him, and I swear to God, he's crying down the phone, like, congratulating me and telling me how great it is. And he asked me, can I come to the final? I said, of course you can.
Don't miss the panel every Saturday afternoon on OTB Sports Radio. Tune in 24/7 on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, very happy to welcome our next guest to the show. He's had a long and varied career in the world of Gaelic games. It is Kevin McStay. Kevin, great to have you with us.
Yeah, hi, Joe. Lovely to be here.
So what's life been like for you then for the past year or so?
Well, not too bad. Not too bad. I say to some of my friends, like, I went to St. Charlotte's as a boarding stroke day boy. And then I went off to the cadet school for nearly 2 years. So lockdown isn't, when you've gone through the military training, officer training in the cadet school, lockdown isn't too bad. But look, it's been very different for sure. Yeah. I kind of came into it after my last efforts with Roscommon. I was quite tired. So it's been, you know, I had kind of a deep tiredness after the management side of it. So it's been good that side. The football kept going throughout it, and I was very privileged, obviously, to get to the games when so many people couldn't, and that helped it. But by and large, the children, they're not children anymore. They're grown-up girls. They were home for a good while, but they're back now, back in their place of employment and enjoyment, I'm sure, and they're plowing on with it. But it's been fine. You know, when the weather is good, it makes a huge difference, as it is here now. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous day. Things like that make a big difference. But by and large, I'm okay with my own company in general, Joe. I don't let it bog me down too much.
And it's home Roscommon town, it is.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I'm actually a well struck 50 away from the back of the stadium here, from where I'm doing this with you.
And how long have you been there?
Let's see, about 1990, I guess. So 30 years or so. Yeah. So my address is actually Hyde Court, as in Dr. Hyde. So I'm right beside the pitch. So getting to training was easy back in the day when I was looking after them.
Why Roscommon? Why did you settle down there in the end?
Halfway house. The best I could do military-wise. I was in Dublin at the time when I got married, and I looked for a transfer to Athlone. And I remember going to see my boss, and he was a very nice fella, but he was very old school. He said, I never told you to get married. you made a big assumption that you'd get down to the West. But in fairness, he did eventually sign my transfer. And I did a few months of commuting, but he eventually signed my transfer. And the best I could do was Athlone. There's no other major barracks, obviously, in Mayo, full-time barracks in Mayo. So I wasn't going that far. And then my wife was working as a teacher at the time in Strokestown. So Roscommon's a halfway house between Strokestown and Athlone, if you know your geography down here. And that's why it was no other reason. Just 20 miles one way from me going to work, 20 miles the other way from Verona.
It's funny, the small things that shape your entire life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading Army 1982 to 2013.
Yeah, that's it. Just about 31 years or so, 32, nearly 32.
And why did you leave?
Why did I leave? That's a good question. Probably I'd had enough, and maybe the army had had enough of me as well. I don't know. I came to a crossroads. I was at a rank where if you were going to go further in your career, it was going to take a lot of travel. It was going to mean working a lot away from home. I'd have to take a posting in Dublin, perhaps, or wherever they sent me. Athlone had closed down. That was a big part of it at the time. There was a big transformation in the military, and Athlone lost its status as a brigade. I don't want to get too technical now, but instead of it being a department, it was now really only a stopping house, if you like. And so the major jobs were gone in that area then for someone that was trying to rise up the ranks. I'd made a decent rank. I was pensionable at that stage. And there was a sense, Joe, that there was other things I wanted to do. I'd hoped to go overseas on my last trip, but there was a bit of a scheduling issue with my superiors, and that didn't sit as well with me as as it should have, I suppose. And it all just came to a head. It was no big deal one way or the other. My time had come, I think. I wasn't willing to put in a couple of big years and then maybe all for nothing, you know. And I very much didn't want to be beholden to anybody to make that decision one way or the other down the tracks. And the children were nearly leaving cert stage and beyond. And I'd been on the road a lot, and I just thought it was, look, it's time now to go home and give a bit of time back to the family and to Verona. She always seemed to be the one picking up the pieces when I was on the road with football or with the military and so on. So that was it. You know, I it's a fantastic career. I think you're aware with that. You're aware of that. It's just one of the great careers, a military career. And I learned so much from it. And I made some great buddies along the way, make some great friends along the way. We're actually planning to go off to Westport, 5 or 6 of us now, once we get our passport sorted out in the middle of June, if it's going to be possible. So I had a great time. A friend of mine says, you make two great decisions about the military, to join it and to leave it. Right. And I think that kind of sums it up.
Yeah. Because I do remember listening to, I don't want to name him because I'll get the name wrong, top of my head, there was a Kilkenny hurler in the show a while back, and he was just saying, oh, not for me. I'm sitting around bored most of the time. Is there an element of that for some people, or does it depend on your rank, or does it depend where you're based? Or
very much so. Very much so. We're a peacetime army. We're not, there isn't wars going on outside the walls.
It struck me as a good complaint in many ways.
Yeah. I can live with it for sure. Now, I had some overseas service. I did 3 trips overseas, 2 to Lebanon and 1 to Kosovo. And they're the pinnacle, really, because now you're putting into practice what it is you spent 20 years perhaps talking about and learning in colleges and at home. I could see absolutely where a guy might be bored to tears with it. There's just lulls, and it's just training and practicing and routine and regimental duties and things like that. And it can be very mundane. But thankfully, I was at a rank and I was moving up along the ranks where it was a new challenge very, very regularly. One of the great things in officer life anyway is that you get a new appointment every 2 or 3 years. So life changes. You know, I was head of sport, for instance, for 3 or 4 years in the military, which you can imagine the fun and games that would have been. And then you go back to a unit and you're commanding officer of a signal unit or a signals unit. Yeah. And so on. So yeah, I had a very, very, very varied career.
And what are the Lebanon and Kosovo experiences like?
They're fabulous, really. From a personal perspective, but obviously it's a very sad affair for the people that you're among, for the locals that you're among. We were in South Lebanon, in around the Tibnin area was our headquarters, and South Lebanon was essentially just been overlooked by Israel, and it was very rough. Not on my trip particularly. We were the very last trip, Joe. On my final trip to Lebanon, we were kind of a packing up trip, almost a logistical trip. But on the earlier trip, where there's a bit of action, it can be hairy enough. And I know friends of mine, colleagues of mine, who were on trips that were extremely hairy. Artillery shells landing, you know, half a mile away from you, and 0.5 ammunition flying over the roof of wherever you're billeted, or that's not fun for anybody. And you know, a lot of lives lost, Irish lives lost over there over the period of Lebanon. It was an incredible experience. And the big thing was I was in command of men every time I went there. So you know, I had people that I was very responsible for, and you know, that idea that whoever you bring out, you bring home. And you know, you're responsible for everything. How, you know, their bedding, their food, their welfare, their morale, their safety, you know, essentially and ultimately. And that's a big responsibility. You can be a young officer in your mid-20s, late-20s, you know, with maybe in charge of 25, 30 men. Then as you get older, the size of the responsibility increases. So that wouldn't be taken lightly. But great experiences, except the local scene was just dreadful. I mean, people that are in the aftermath of wars or in the middle of wars. It's just a shocking existence, and very little you can do. Very little you can do. I mean, we were only peacekeepers. We were only kind of holding the line, and fully in the knowledge that at any minute, if a superior power like Israel wants to do anything, they'll just do it. So you're really, you know, you're there, but you're not gonna stop anything major happening.
And what type of leader did you try and be in that environment?
Well, you know, when we go to college and to the military colleges, they teach all the different models of leadership and styles of it. But a friend of mine a long time ago kind of said, you know, it's going to be very hard to beat old-fashioned good example. And I'd like to think that's the way I'd be, you know, that I'd be up in time. I'd be dressed appropriately. I'd be knowledgeable in my brief, whatever it was I had to attend to. I'd know my men. I'd know everything about them. When I say men, I mean men and women, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'd know everything about them, whether they're married, how they were doing at home. I'd have a real interest in them. And I hope an empathy with them. And I'd be as firm and as fair as I could be. And that would be my way of going about it. I that there would be nothing you'd ask them to do that you wouldn't be willing to do yourself. And that whole idea of putting them definitely before your needs and wants, and that they would be out. It's almost like sports management, you know. The players have to be out first, you know. The leaders eat last, and that's the way it has to be. And I had great relationships with my troops overseas. I like to think I had, anyway, so we'd have to ask them, but I pretty much know I had. And And they enjoy their time with me as I did with them. And my superiors and subordinates, I got on really well with on those trips. And you have to, because it's a very enclosed environment, and people have to get on. And I think that might be one of my best attributes. I get on with people. I'm interested in people, and I'm interested in their circumstances.
And is it a very small world, the Army? Like, would you have spent time with Dermot Early Sr.?
Yeah, well, not time with them, but I came across him a lot because I played football with them and against him. In fact, Joe, I refereed an All-Army final. I had retired, and Dermot was a lieutenant colonel up in Dundalk. Jeez, he had to be 46, 7, something like that. And he played fullback for his unit team. He was the commanding officer, and he played fullback. And I refereed that final. And they won it, actually. So I came across him a lot. He visited us in Kosovo. We had a fantastic visit from him in Kosovo about 2007. They were just about to get their independence and become a new nation, essentially, Kosovo. So we're billeted around Pristina, the capital there. And I remember Dermot came out, and I had a lot of soldiers from Cork, a different place. They didn't really know who Dermot was, but we had one of those kind of town hall meetings, and Dermot, as only he could, you know, when he went up to the rostrum, he just took over the hall. And he had young soldiers who had never come across him before, knew he was the chief, of course, and he had them eating out of his hands. I remember he said one thing which has always stayed with me about his support for his subordinates and anybody that worked under him, and he said this to everybody, and kind of gave I think the younger leaders, anyway, in the place, the junior leaders, a great sense of somebody having their back. He said, if you're well intentioned and things go wrong, he said, you'll have my full support, but don't have bad intentions, and don't be trying to take a shortcut or do a slobber job. But if you're well-intentioned and you are putting the best face of the military front and center, you'll have my full backing, even if things go slightly awry. So he was a great fella. I didn't come across him that much because he was obviously on a very senior career path. But any of my dealings with them, as you can imagine, they were outstanding moments. And you never met Dermot, but your day didn't improve.
Yeah, he does seem to have been an amazing man.
He was. He just was. He just had it. He just had that gift of making you feel very, very important, and a big part of whatever it is was under discussion.
So 1982 to 2013, What effect do you think the army had on you as a person? How did it shape you as a person? Because you went in young if you went in 82.
Well, actually, I went in old, believe it or not. I was nearly 19 and a half, nearly 20. I'd gone to the RTC in Galway. Did you ever hear of an institution? Now GMIT. But it was the old, there were the old colleges, technical colleges. I'd gone there for a year. I tried for the army once or twice before that, at least once before that. But the cadets is it's a needle in a haystack job. You know, there was a lot of applicants for very few places. And I like to think that talent could get overlooked very easily by accident. But on the, I think on the second or third go anyway, I got it. So I was a little bit older than my classmates, but young still, 19 and a half is still young. But some of them were 17 and a half. Some of my classmates were 2 years younger than me, I'd imagine. Yeah, I went in quite young in 1982 because, I wanted to be in it. There wasn't a whole lot of other jobs around the place anyway, yeah. To tell you the truth. It was kind of join the bank or Junior X, a few of those things were going on. But I was delighted to get the army. And because I, in my head, I thought I was going to be almost a professional sportsman in the place. You know, I kind of notions of being a top soccer player and a top Gaelic footballer and top everything that was going on. And this is going to facilitate it for me, but it wasn't quite that.
Mm. And so how do you think it shaped you then? I mean, 19 might late going in, but you're still young as a person, young as a man.
Yeah. Well, I needed the army badly, I say. You know, I was a bit of a messer, Joe. Not in a sinister way or anything like that, but you know, I was messing in college. I wasn't taking things that seriously, really. I'd kind of drifted from football. I was quite an accomplished minor, but I hadn't bothered after minor. You know, I really wasn't playing much football. Kind of one of those, you know, you just come to 19 and you kind of get lost to it. So I was in that kind of moment where I could have gone, and I don't know where I could have gone, maybe thinking of heading off to England. And I don't really know what far I was heading to England for, but that's what I was kind of half thinking.
Yeah.
And then I got the army, and there is no doubt they banged me into the shape that I needed. I needed a bit of banging into, and, taught me routine and discipline. And being responsible and copping myself on, I suppose, really. And that was a big influence for sure. And of course, physical fitness was a big part of it. And the idea of sticking at something and persevering with whatever it was you were at. Organizational skills, that's a huge part of what they teach you. So yeah, I needed a good bit of aligning, and I got plenty of it. And
so, eight years on, I mean, is your bed freshly made every morning? Is there a crease in your trousers? Are you in time for everything? Is it, are all these kind of habits ingrained now?
Yeah, I could give you an answer to that, and my wife would be falling around the place laughing when she listens to this interview. But no, funny enough, it's not that sort of. I wouldn't describe myself as the classic military person, if that makes sense.
Mm.
You know, I took the best from it. I wouldn't be overly regimental about things. Now, apparently I come across like that sometimes to people I don't know, but I'd be well organized, but I'd be tardy enough by times. Like, I have a friend that thinks I'm never at training on time. I'm always 10, 15 minutes late. Definitely wouldn't be making the bed with a crease or anything like that. And the best parts of it, the important parts of it, hope I brought with me. In the career that I've had since that.
So McStay, the player, 83 to 90 with Mayo. I make it via Wikipedia, so this could be wrong, but I make it 17 championship appearances. You don't get as many in those days with knockout. Yeah. I make it 2 Connacht titles. I make it 1 All-Star. So you won Connacht in 85 and 89. I make it that you broke your leg twice in 88 and 90. I mean, that's a bloody ordeal to do it twice in 88 and 90. And if I pick up 1983, the very start, just to give people a glimpse of how different this world was, and like, we are talking different. Am I right in saying 1983, so you're a year in the army at that stage, you've never trained with the Mayo senior team, you've never played with the Mayo senior team, you've won an under 21 All-Ireland, so you're obviously back playing and going well, but you find out in the Barbers, courtesy of the Evening Press back page, that you're going to play your first game for Mayo, and it'll be a Connacht final. This is a world that is so far out of reach of my imagination that it's extraordinary to think that was going on.
Yeah, that's you pretty much have it, except one small detail. We hadn't won our All-Ireland at that stage.
Oh, the under-21, you hadn't, right.
Yeah, because that went on into the October period. Okay. And
so you're even more unproven then.
Yeah, well, I think we played a match against Leitrim, I'd say a quarter-final perhaps, of that under-21. And again, I'd never seen the under-21 panel. I didn't know anything about them. I just knew John O'Mahony was the new manager. And beyond, see, you're so busy in the cadet school. It's another life. It's a, like you talk about bubbles these days. I mean, this was sealed off. Nobody got in or got out. And like there was no phones. So, you know, it was letter writing. That's how you got notified about things. And I knew at the beginning of kind of joining that there was a guy called John O'Mahony taking over. And beyond that, you see, I wasn't really playing football, Joe, as I think I said to you, around 19, 19 and a half, 20. I just had gone, you know, I was up in Galway in the RTC. I was
The beer.
Just tooling around and, you know, taking nothing too serious. And John picked me for, I went home. I went home to play a league match for Ballina, a senior league match, you know, the county leagues, Division One or whatever. And we were playing Gary Moore, they were a big swing at the time. And I was marking a fellow called Dick Mellett, if my memory is right. And he was kind of like the center back for Mayo or close to the center back for Mayo. And I would have been, you know, small. And that would have been the big issue with me trying to make a breakthrough. Most people would have said I was just too small and it wasn't going to happen. But I now had 6 or 7 months of outrageous training behind me in the cadet school. I was as fit as a fiddle. And I would have ran the guy I was marking up and down all day. So, and he mightn't have been as ready for a league match now as I was. And out of that, then John picked me, and against Leitrim, I got a massive score against Leitrim playing at centre forward. And I think Mayo were just so poor up front at senior level that they were willing to take a chance on anything. And exactly as you said, I was getting my hair cut on a Tuesday night, and the local barber, is a fellow called Reggie Darling in the Curragh camp. He was there's a guy there, one of your buddies is playing for Mayo, he said on Sunday, and he threw it to me, and I said, well, that's actually me. And I had one of those kind of Jimmy Barry Murphy 1983 haircuts or 1973 haircuts, and for the Sunday. They were the times that were in it, Joe. They were very, you know, they were very different.
Mad.
I trotted up to McHale Park on the Saturday, went into the dressing room to say hello to fellas. I had no clue who they were. I think I knew Martin Carney. I knew of him. I didn't know him. I knew of him. And most of the team I wouldn't have known. And I just practiced on the Saturday, kicked a few balls, went back to the barracks in Castlebar and showed up on Sunday and played the Connacht final and lost it.
Shock.
And I did okay. I mean, I did fine. I wasn't a disgrace.
Mm.
And then I went on, you know, the next 6 or 7 years just zoomed by. And the big downer for me was breaking my legs. That was the killer, really. You know,
88 and 90.
Because I was still very young, really, you know, like 1998, I'm only 25, coming 26, you know.
Okay.
And
did you break the same leg?
No, and I broke the other bloody one then.
Similar 90. Incidents or just?
The first one was a tough one. I was playing Army rugby. Would you believe?
Well, that was your first fullback. Mistake.
Well, do you see, I wasn't really, I didn't play Army rugby, but they were short a man and the general was going to watch them. So their manager said, Jesus, there's no way we can be showing up with 15 men. We get killed tomorrow by the boss. And so he got his hands on me, and you know, the usual guy to put your fullback to take the kicks or something. Yeah. And anyway, halfway through it, I broke my leg.
And what about 90?
Oh, 90 then, it was my own fault in 90. I went in after a ball, I had no ball, and it was wet, and I slipped, and poor old Henry Gavin, who was an old teammate, he was that captain in 85 when we won Connacht, I flew into his knee, and I did a bad job on my leg, Joe. Yeah, I had to get it plated, and I broke it in a good few places, and...
Did that finish you?
That was it. I never played again for Mayo Seniors.
Did that break your heart, or were you okay with it?
Well, we'd lost in '89 the All Ireland, and there was a sense that the team was breaking up, perhaps, or the older fellas. And would I have waited around long enough for John Mahon's coming? I don't know, because in fairness to John, I remember he contacted me at one stage and said, "Would you not come in and get yourself fairly, you know, reasonably fit to play for 20 minutes or something?" I just wouldn't have had the staying power for. Like, I felt like I'd put a fair bit into it. I hadn't really been overseas with my military career, because, you know, every summer you're trying to win something with Mayo, and I'd kind of put that on hold a little bit. And a lot of lads were going to be calling it a day. And yet, you know, if I'd said injury free, who knows? But that's just one of life's unknowns. But the broken leg the second time was just, wow, it was terrible, because I'd spent nearly a year out. You know, it was actually, when you mentioned, I think I played, was it 17 times, you said, or something there?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I can't believe that. If you had said 47, I would have, you know, I might have, I had no sense that it was that now. But it goes to show you, like, one and done, you know, and how many times that happened to us, you know.
Reading the other day, Keith Higgins has played 90 championship matches for
Mayo. My God.
90. Yeah, yeah. That's not including league, so.
Oh, Jesus. 90 championship. Yeah, God.
So we 17.
Got, you know, yeah, so there I am. What's that? I had an 8-year career with Mayo, we'll say, up to when I got injured. And 17 games, so two matches a year.
Not much of a return, is it?
Yeah, and like the horror is, and it's, I'm sure lots of players of my vintage will say it, that we actually had the makings of a good team, and we just got caught some years, as in the first round or the quarterfinal, and couldn't get any momentum. And then you're at the bottom of the mountain again, you know, the following year. You're just nowhere again, you're not mapped, and you have to start all over again.
Mm.
So to answer your question, I was very frustrated the second time breaking my leg, because I knew immediately what was ahead of me, that in terms of rehab, that it just wasn't going to happen for me. And I left it at that then at that stage. I played a bit of club football then. I came back actually with my club here locally, because I was married now at this stage and living here in Roscommon. Someone at the door. So really, I was calling it a day at that stage. But I came back and played with the Gales, the local team here, and actually captained the team to a championship in 94. So, and that was, I knocked a good laugh out of that. Now I must say that was quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then I managed that club team then thereafter, and we had a little bit of success here and there. So yeah, I enjoyed that as well, but. A county level, I had only one ambition, Joe, and that was to get my medal and get out. I wouldn't have been looking for a two in a row, I can assure you. One would have been lovely. So it's kind of regret that I didn't win the medal, or that group, that, because they were a lovely group of fellas, and you know, to this day I would have great time for the vast majority of them. They were a great bunch of fellas.
With Anthony,
I'm sure
Finnerty
you bumped into a few of them.
Finnerty on a roadshow last year, and Jesus, he's a whole different level, isn't he?
God, he's fantastic.
What's your strongest memory of playing in an All Ireland final in '89 against Cork then?
Oh, being so close. I mean, I could, when Anthony, just speaking of Anthony, when Anthony got a smashing goal, actually Noel Durkin made it from a fantastic catch on the edge of the square and a lovely little offload, and Anthony rifled it into the net, and there was a huge crowd behind the canal, Mayo crowd, and I remember the noise level of, you know, realizing, I thought there was a good bit gone, like say 25 minutes or so, but I don't think there was. It was only maybe around 15 or 20 perhaps, and just thinking, oh God, these guys, this is Cork's third time now. They're not going to be able to hold this. And we had some really gilt-edged chances after that, myself included, to score. Anthony had another great goal chance. We had about three easy enough point chances and we didn't take them. And that gave Cork the little breather to reorganize and regather themselves. And then, you know, they pushed on. But there was a fantastic 3-4 minutes when it felt we were going to win the All-Ireland. And I remember that very, you know, I really believed it, Joe. I'd no sense that we were going to lose to Cork. And yet, until you get into the position we're going to beat them, you know, how can you say I knew we were going to? You don't, but you build yourself up to believe it can be done. But when Anthony got the goal, I really had that 4 or 5 minutes where, Jesus, we are going to win this All Ireland. Mm.
How did you spend that night, do you remember?
Having more drinks than I should have had. Anyway, I do remember that. I would have been, I'm not a good loser, really, certainly of big matches. And I remember my wife had to, well, she was my girlfriend at the time, had to get back to Stroke, so I'm back to school somehow, and trying to arrange lifts and things like that. And there was a banquet on, I think we're out in the Marine, out right. in, where's the Marine again? Is it Dundurry?
Yeah.
I think it is. And we were out there, if I remember. And it was just like, you know, when you're build up and you for what you're hoping is going to be the night of your life and it's not, well, it's a damn squib. And we had to fly home the next day, Joe. That was a killer. Oh, you know, yeah, they had organized.
Knock Airport, the homecoming.
Yeah.
Hype.
Well, and as you do, you know, I mean, I know the hype and all that, but like, that's what you do. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. You have to plan to win it. I mean, who goes planning not to win it? You know. So, But I was very struck by it. Was a dirty, old, damp west of Ireland Monday evening. Bit of a pisser around Knock. It's on high ground anyway, and right. Almost cold and lashing. And I remember coming down the plane and just seeing thousands of wet Mayo people lined up against a gnarled fence around the airport. And I must say that I did find that very, very emotional, you know, that we ultimately we hadn't delivered. Because I'm not a believer in woulda, couldas, or shouldas. Like, you get your chance, you get out there, and you do it on the pitch. You know, the players get it right, the managers get it right, everybody gets it right, and you win it. And if you don't, you don't. Mm. That's the way it is. And I give up on hard luck stories an awful long time ago. I got bitter about winning as I got older, you know, when I was in charge of teams or something. I just had no time for a fella that might be only half performing in a big match, or people that weren't ready for the, like, you get a shot at this, it's everything you want, get out there and do it, and have no regrets, just do it. And you know, I always have a sense, if you give it everything, and I like to think I did when I was involved in it, I can look you in the eye the next day and say, well, look, Joe, I gave this my best shot. Didn't work out. They're better than us. Cork are better than us, or whoever's better than us, they've beaten us, and fair enough. But don't come near me if you haven't given it your best shot. Mm. You know, I think that's just a horrible way to conduct yourself.
To jump around a little bit then, and because I really want to hear what life is like for the modern day inter-county manager, and you had your time at Roscommon, obviously, very, very recently. To set the context at that stage, you'd won an All-Ireland with Bridget's. So that's, you know, that's a huge deal and a huge achievement. And you had gone for the Mayo job in 95, and obviously Mahon comes in then. And then you went for it after Horan was done with his first stint, and Holmes and Kennelly got that one. Now, the second that the Holmes and Kennelly one, given what you'd done with Bridget's, given your profile, given I think you were the only horse in the race, actually, which, you know, that would go a long way, you would think. You were generally expected to come through there. That was kind of your time, and that didn't happen. And the Holmes and Kennelly thing worked out the way it worked out. So you were pretty sore about that, I would think. You were pretty unimpressed with how that was handled. Why didn't you get that job? Do you know? Why didn't your face fit?
I want to be fair to everybody, I suppose, now in this. The interview I did, perhaps, I might have been too honest at it. Now, when I say the interview, it wasn't really an interview because I had the job, because I was the only candidate, as you rightly pointed out. And yet, 24 hours after that interview, one or two friends of mine and Mayor were able to tell me, you're not going to get that job, that there's other people who are in the race but not seeing it. You know, and that was very disappointing for me, that people I knew, people I played with, were on panels with, you know, who were saying publicly they had no interest in the job, or actually talking about the position, while I thought in my head I was actually crossing T's and dotting I's with the Mayo management. I have a sense that perhaps at the meeting I said too much in terms of what my vision for the team was, and that there might have to be some changes. And that was leaked to certain players. I would say that was an issue. It was a very difficult time, Joe, for me personally. You know, I had put all my hopes and dreams on, you know, I knew there was very little between Mayo and All-Ireland. And I knew James had brought it to the nth. I think he went after the Kerry game down in Limerick, which was an unbelievable game of football that really, all things been equal, you know, Mayo should have won. There was, you know, they were very unlucky with, I think Aidan O'Shea walked into someone and concussed himself, and someone else, can't remember now, someone else, another noted player anyway, got injured at a critical stage. It was a very poor refereeing performance by the Meath official. I can't think of his name now, just off the top of my head. And all those things just, Kerry sneaked over the line in extra time. And James just called it a day. I'd say he was exhausted. You know, he had taken a few big hits. And I just really felt with a couple of little tweaks and a new voice, my confidence levels were high after the Bridget's All-Ireland. And I felt, that I'd waited long enough. I mean, just about everybody at that stage that was managing Mayo was getting two shots at it. You know, Jono or John Mahon or... you know, etc. I was kind of thinking, surely I get one shot at it. So when I was the only guy in the field, yeah, of course I thought, well, now's your time. You've been talking enough about it and dreaming enough about it. Now just get in there and get the job done and get the All-Ireland one. But I think there was a sense that other people saw that there was a great chance of winning the All-Ireland as well, and that it might lie better if somebody else was in charge when they won it. And there were certainly family issues at stake in it. And I don't really want to be too particular about that. No point at this stage. But certainly officers were tangled up in it. And they used a very easy excuse that the budget that we were discussing, you know, was off the Richter scale. But the fine detail in that, you know, was well lost when the noise built up around it. As in, I think the following year, there were many multiples of thousands over budget. So, you know, all these things are added to and multiplied. But the bottom line for Joe was I didn't get the job. And the way it was handled was shocking, you know. I mean, officers ringing me to tell me they wouldn't support me, but they wanted me to come down to do an interview so as to save their face. You know, that sort of carry on. I mean, it was Keystone Cops. I remember one of the officers asking me, would I tidy up the statement they were about to release so that it'd be acceptable? And the statement was about my candidacy. You know, that sort of stuff. Like, they were so far out of their depth in what they were trying to do. And I did feel very sore about that for a long time. But thankfully, Roscommon gave me a magnificent chance to challenge myself at this level, and I'll be forever grateful for that. But
because you might be still sore if you hadn't got the chance at intercounty level, I wonder.
Well, I was certainly, because of the Bridget's experience, Joe, I was kind of thinking this isn't as difficult as perhaps I had imagined it to be. You know, right. When I'm say doing punditry and I'm looking at Mickey Hart in action and all these great managers over the years. And so on. And I mightn't have had that deep confidence in myself that I can do this. But then I had a great experience with Bridget's. Now, they were an outstanding team. So, you know, they only took a certain amount of management. It's always helpful if you're managing a top team. Okay. You know that. Life is a lot easier. But certainly, I now had the confidence levels to say I certainly can contribute something. And that something might be all the difference, you know. I knew I could definitely add to the attacking ideas of any team I'm involved with. And that seemed to be the Achilles heel at the time for Mayo. So, yeah, it was incredibly disappointing. And I had a tough time for a while after that. You know, when you're rejected by your own people, it's not very nice. It was very public, you know, and it hung around like a bad smell for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, perhaps.
Mm.
And it really was. It was a hard time, but you know, I never lost my love for Mayo, as in Mayo football. But there was certainly some guys around the scene, and events afterwards very much showed it to be that way. You know, I mean, the Pat Holmes, Noel Kennelly era finished very badly. The Stephen Rochford was handled atrociously, shocking, to treat former players and contributors to the scene in the way they did. But I have a great sense it's tidied up now. There's a lot of that old egotry has been tidied up a lot, and have a new chairman, a very forward thinking guy, and Liam Moffat down there, and they just seem to be better at doing their business now.
Well, I think I get the impression as well. Horan runs a tight ship, and he's not allowing any nonsense to get into the media. He did that in his first stint, and it was amazing how quickly, you know, the world of Mayo quietened down again. Although then there was, there was the stuff then, which, you know, the benefactor and all this carry on as well. So, geez, it's never dull there either, is it?
Yeah. Well, do you see, it's like the Cubs, isn't it? And the longer you wait, it just becomes a huge story. And Mayo is, it's an amazing interest story because of everybody getting so close. And I don't know, it's almost a tragedy, you know, the whole circumstances of Mayo football since 1950-51. And yet it's not the tragedy we all build it up to be. It is what it is. You know, one of these fine days, Mayo are going to win the All-Ireland.
They're no also doubt. After having about the best 20 years of any county in the last, you know,
bar winning it, of course, bar is winning the detractors. Yeah. But we've had some spin, you know,
and you know, like the immigration and everything else, think of the many weekends people have flown in from all around the world and the opportunity it's given for families to get together and go to the matches. And okay, they sit around and it's miserable afterwards. And you know what it's like in Dublin, 6-7 o'clock, mm-hmm. and the sun's setting and Jesus, it's happened again. But you know what? There's almost, I think at this stage, a sense of, it'll happen eventually, and isn't it great we're all together here? The other 30 counties aren't.
Yeah, we've had, I was actually, I was writing about it before this year's All-Ireland and trying to capture that sense of it.
Yeah.
And I was looking back at a lot of different reports and bits of history, trying to give the piece a bit of context. And the one thing, you know, I remember Marty Marcy said to me a long, long time ago, Galway were after killing us in a Connacht final. And I was the coach. I'm trying to get the year now. It'd be around, I think, before John Mahan came in, maybe about 94, 95, maybe. I think it is 95, actually. And Anthony Egan was the manager. We got an awful scutcheon above in Tuam anyway. And they're finding it hard to get someone to go out to meet the RTE camera. And I was kind of honor bound to do it. So I went out anyway. And I remember Marty saying, like, you know, oh God, where do you go now? Mm. Like, as if the option is you give up.
Yeah.
Like, what do you, like, you can't, it's like the team you follow, you know, you can't just walk away from them. They're your team.
Mm.
And Mayo football has been through many ups and downs over the years. But by and large, as you've just outlined, the modern history of Mayo is absolutely fantastic, except for the big fella in the corner. And I just feel that there's such a passion for it down there that this quest will just go on and on. And one of these fine days, a Mayo senior football team will fall over the line and win All-Ireland. And then we'll all wonder, what was the big hullabaloo about?
Yeah. I don't want to keep you all day. So Roscommon then. A lot of good achievements there. Division 2 title, Connacht title, first in 7 years for Roscommon, back-to-back quarterfinals. You went in initially with Fergal O'Donnell, joint manager for 16. And then how rough is it to have to turn in and be honest and say, this isn't working. We're going to have to, you know, either you're going to have to take it on or I'm going to have to take it on. We're going to have to figure out something here. But ultimately, this great idea we had isn't working. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't it working? And did you try and not have to face that for a while?
It's to answer, I think the first question is that, you know, how tough is it to come to that decision? It's shocking, Joe, when friendships are involved.
And he was a friend, was he? Yeah.
Well, not a close friend, but a fellow I had huge respect for. I'd played with him on that team I was talking about that we won the club with, and I'd managed him. He was in towards the end of his career, a fantastic player for us. Like, he essentially won it on his own, a marvelous player for us. And I had huge respect for him. You know, like, he was a marvelous reputation around the county here as a footballer and as a football person. And so I was, you know, very, very friendly with him. But he wasn't a guy I'd been seeing every minute of every day prior to our coming. And that happens in football a lot. Yeah. You know, I don't call them, you're not besties with these people, but, you know, I'd meet Anthony Finnerty tomorrow, we're friends again, you know, but I haven't seen him in, you know, 2 years perhaps, but the minute you get into his company, you know, here's one of my old friends, you know, and that type of thing. So it was very difficult, you know. And
does that kill the relationship?
It does, very much so. Yeah, I mean, he was very hurt about it. I know, I totally understand that, because he thought, you know, like we all did, to repeat that Dermot Early story, I said, we all went in very well intentioned. I say that all the time about it. There was no agenda from anybody, none. There was no egos around our get up, I can tell you that. And it just was not providing the environment that I thought we could do well in. We had a young team, and there was a lot of tough love around it, because there had to be, because Roscommon were, you know, I think they're had lost to Fermanagh, I think, in a qualifier. You know, they were just not. Roscommon were losing too many ordinary games that they should have won. Mm. There are games that Roscommon won't win, but then there's another tranche of games that they should win, and they weren't. So we went in eyes wide open, saying this is a massive job. But the first year of it, I'm going to have to take most of the responsibility for it, because I put together the management team, and it just did not gel. And I don't mean as in there was rows or blazing rows. It just didn't create the conditions for us that I thought was going to lead ultimately to success. And I thought joint management would be a great idea, Joe, but it wasn't. It just wasn't. I wasn't having the influence I wanted to have. I'd say Fergal was having to check with me on everything he wanted to do, and that may not have sat well with him either. Then Liam was trying to find a role as a coach versus David and Stephen, the other coaches, and it just wasn't a nice hand in glove situation. And then the defeat to Clare, you know, where we were so poor, you know, we were very low on morale, very low on energy, but mostly low on morale. It was a game that we were going to lose the minute we lost to Galway, if you know what I mean. And that shouldn't be. You know, we should have been ultra competitive against Clare above in Pierce Stadium, but we weren't. And then I decided that we were going to have to change things. And once you make that decision, it's done. Mm. And you have to go through with it. And I know that was very, very difficult for the lads involved, but I did it for the best of intentions, so that Roscommon senior football team I thought would go a certain journey and show improvement. And during our time, and just to state the facts, we won every competition that Roscommon can reasonably be expected to win, and that was a big improvement from where we had been. You know, Roscommon won't be winning the National League Division 1 title. They won't be winning the All-Ireland. These are competitions that are just beyond the level of calibre, the level of ability that the group has, and perhaps Roscommon have had for a long, long time. But we can win Connacht titles from time to time. We can win Division 2 titles from time to time. We can win the FPD title. And we held all three of those at the one time. We got back to Division 1 football, which was great for us. That was the reason we won Connacht. You know, we had that exposure, even though it was a bad exposure, but we'd had it. And the players are very, very experienced now. You know, winning a Connacht would not be a shock for Roscommon now at this stage. I mean, Anthony came in after me and won a Connacht very quickly. So it was a great experience, Joe, but it was so challenging. I had, you know, I had the management issue in 2016, I had the player issue in 2017, and then in 2018, you know, there was the financial issues with the board. They were under huge pressure. The pitch was trying, they were trying to get a new pitch opened. All that stuff was going on. Every week there seemed to be a challenge that not only was I involved in training or managing a football team, but there were so many other issues going on and side issues that I was just, at the end of the season, I was very, very tired. I was exhausted from the period. And then some of my players then decided that they were going to take a break, which they're totally entitled to do. You know, as I said, life gets in the way of, or work gets in the way of sport. Life gets in the way of sport very often. That's fine. But I just didn't feel then we had enough, we had a critical mass to go on and make a big effort again. And I left it at that.
Right.
And but I had a happy, I had a great time. I mean, the people, the decent people that support Roscommon, they were great. They were just marvelous supporters. Very like Mayo, very, very close to Mayo, very passionate about it and feel they should be in a heavier weight division all the time. You know, really want to stand up their full height and have a cut at it. So they wouldn't be bowing the knee to anybody around Roscommon. I can tell you they'll have a shot at it. They might, like, they mightn't be winning them, but they'll have a good cut. And I really enjoyed that part of them. I loved that attitude of them. I, you know, I often wished some of the male lads had a bit more of that sort of self-belief and cut in them, because they could do with a bit of it. So yeah, that was it. I had three great years, Joe. I really, really enjoyed it. But at the end, I'd had enough. And
now, if you got another call from a county, would you listen?
Well, I remember saying at the time, no, I'm done. No, I said that at a time when I was exhausted, I suppose, and I just wanted to get out of the whole scene. I'd say I'm done, but then COVID came, and now I'd say I'm, you know, quite rejuvenated and I'm energized. And if, well, there's only one county I would be interested at this stage in managing, but I just don't see that happening. I you don't get three shots at it, I don't think. But yeah, I mean, I how should I put it? I don't think so, Joe. I'd say I'm done. But I'm not 60 just yet. I have a lot of experience. Maybe I could be involved in a group or something. I don't know. I wouldn't absolutely rule it out like I did previously. Let me put it that way. But I see only good things ahead for what Mayo are doing at the moment. I think James is bringing on a lot of very good players again, and it won't take long before they're turned around.
Yeah,
there's some quality players down in Mayo again. I know Lee McHale, my brother-in-law, was involved with the under-15s there a few years ago down the academy. And he just said, Jesus, these guys are monsters that are coming through, and they're athletes, and they have very high skill level. And geez, Mayo are going to have some serious players in another 5 or 6 years' time. You know, so that's great to hear. And what James did last year with three or four of them, well, you saw them, three of them got into the player of the year category. Wasn't it three Mayo lads? It was the three of them. I mean, that's a fair tog in their rookie year, essentially. And there's plenty of them. There's plenty more of them, as I understand. So I expect James will be having a good shot at this for the next few years to see what he can do with it.
I would think so. I always remember your time with finances would crop up occasionally. You'd mention about the financial situation, and you even alluded to it there. Now, the Dubs will be texting in saying money can't kick the ball over a bar, lads, which is the text we get. So give us the riposte to that for a county like Roscommon, a population like Roscommon. You trying to compete, you know, money is an issue.
A very simple
is it?
One. Yeah, I'll give you a very simple one.
Yeah.
Right now, as I'm speaking to you, Roscommon GA do not own a square meter of grass on which they can train their senior football team, other than Hyde Park. They don't own 50 watts of light on a floodlight of which they could turn on at nighttime to train their seniors, their senior team. They don't have it. They don't have a center of excellence. They don't have training pitches. They don't have floodlights. So when I took over, I did a deal with Bridget's, because obviously I had a relationship with them, where we were contracted for the 3 years to train on one of their pitches, which had floodlights, and they had a spare pitch. But it's a business arrangement between the board and Bridget's. So to put that in context, we don't have anything compared to what other counties have. We just do not have them. So it's all, you're at the behest of clubs all the time or whatever arrangements you have in place. Also, when I was there, I think I had 34 in my panel and 20, I wonder if it's correct. Well, I know it's either 25, 26 or 27. I'm not sure what the number, it's one of those three numbers, were living away from home. Okay, so you can imagine the sort of transport bill our treasurer would have to face. Trying to get guys down from Dublin, Temple Moor, UCG, all the universities in Dublin, as I mentioned, and so on. They just come from the four corners. The feeding bill associated with that. Yeah. And then, of course, we had legacy debt. When Fergal and myself actually came into the job, there was a lot of legacy debt around the place. So there was, you know, just no money to do anything. You know, I tell the story, and I'm sure the Roscommon management won't, our officials won't mind me saying it. We got involved in 2017 with, you know, this AIB and...
You got them in the dressing room.
Yeah, something tough, the Make It Tougher campaign or something. Yeah. And which, of course, was, you know, a risky sort of thing to do. But, you know, we struck a good deal with them in terms of a few bob for the group. And that's the money that paid for our hotel for the replay against Mayo.
Right.
Otherwise, we were coming up in the morning.
Really?
Yeah. And that's where we were back then.
Mm.
That's the level of difficulty that we had. And I remember it covered the Crown Plaza for the Saturday night and the meal and stuff afterwards. And and that's...
These are basics.
These are basics. When a manager goes in and the chairman, the best heart in the world, says, you know, I don't think we have the twine to cover another trip to Dublin, you know. So these are our realities. And I've argued as strongly as I can, and I think I've been shown to be right, that this could all be done at central level in terms of transport, could be vouched to Croke Park, and certainly the food bills could be vouched at central level. This is how you equalize the disparities. This is essentially how PHI and the different health insurers deal with the young and old clients. So of course Croke Park could pay for transport at central level. And then that would be the Western Seaboard counties, the Donegals, the Mayos, the Roscommons, the Clares, the Galways, that don't have these massive transportation bills that other, that, you know, small counties or counties that are more centrally located or have employment, I suppose, ultimately, don't have to face. And the same with food and the same accommodation. I think if it's vouched, and we want to be fair about it, you know, if there's going to be equality and fraternity among the nations, of course this can be done at central level. And I see now that they've done it during the COVID period, perhaps it's a model that they will bring forward. I hope it is, because it gives Roscommon the possibility of putting the resources somewhere else. They really badly want to do something with the stadium, and they want to get, speaking of the man that we opened our chat with, they want to get the Dermot Early Centre of Excellence up and running as well. They have very nice ideas for it, but ultimately, Joe, it's the moolah. They don't have the twine to get the job done. And that's an awful pity, because if we had those facilities, they would be used day in and day out. I've no doubt about that. And that's the only way the Roscommons can catch up. They're great to be as good as they are. I think Roscommon are a fantastic county to be so competitive in Connacht against, you know, in the shadow of two big guns with big population. I think Roscommon's only about 63,000-64,000 people. Yeah. You know, Mayo would have four times that, Galway more again, you know. So they're definitely fight beyond their weight division, there's no doubt, and give it their best shot. And, you know, they're yo-yoing between Division 1 and 2, but, like, they're kind of top 8, you know. You mentioned the two All-Ireland quarterfinals in a row. Like, Roscommon don't do that too regularly. So I think they've been tremendous for the game of Gaelic games the last few years. Now, you might say, I would say that, but, no, I think in Anthony's time, in John Evans's time, when they were moving up through the divisions, I think Roscommon has been a great story. And look what they've done with their finances, with the Sean Mulryan, Tom Hunt-backed efforts and the Win a House thing. I'm sure you were following that. Where they made over €1 million on it, you know, and they've turned their finances into a very positive situation. They're just a brilliant GAA story. and people don't realize the efforts they're putting in.
No, and it's great to hear it, because we don't, it's not something we get to publicize that often or hear that much about at national level. One very last one then, Sunday game and RTE and all that, and the institution that it is, and you've been there for many a year. I'm always conscious, even on the show, we're talking about amateurs here, and there has to be fairness. It would strike me punditry has become less personal over the last decade or so. What are you seeing or feeling in an RTE studio?
What do you mean by less personal, as in you cut deeper, is it? Or
I feel like there's less personal criticism and less really singling lads out and really having a cut at them and a go at them. A touch softer.
I got you.
Or maybe it's not.
Well, I don't think I've changed. I can only speak for myself, but I'll give you a sense of the background and the context of those programs. And I'll put this straight out there. I have never, Joe, and I've never been present when any member of production, any of the executives around sport have come in and said, well, now you must take this line. Or no, our position is this. Mm. None. Do you think you'd tell that to Joe Brawley or Colm O'Rourke or Pat Spillane, these guys? Or I'd like to include myself. I mean, I wouldn't be anybody's mouthpiece. That wouldn't be my
to be fair, I never get that sense. I don't even think it's been a deliberate thing. I actually think it's just a natural thing in society. I think it applies to the rugby panels of the George Hook era and Eamon Dunphy era versus now. I think society's a little bit softer. I think we see that in our punditry.
Well, I suppose maybe we've tidied up the way we say things. Maybe that's where, and maybe it was time we did, because even I'm here at home, and during COVID, my three girls are around, and I might say something loose at the table that just is totally unacceptable to this generation, and you know, who they just want everything to be so fair and right, this kind of, I won't say PC gone mad, but. Maybe our language could be a bit emotive by time. You know, when, say, Gerlach Dan or someone who's in a full rant, like it's great TV and all that. But there's a fair few grenades been fired out that, you know, 24 hours later, when someone backs off from it, because, well, actually, there was a lot of that now wasn't actually correct. You know, but it was great at the time. And maybe there is that sense, Joe, that you have it. I have a little bit of it myself, that it's not as the cut and thrust of it. I think maybe that's where you're coming from. Yeah. Is not there that it was previously. But a lot of that previous stuff was a lot of bluster involved in it too. Now, the Dunphy Hook era, it was great TV. I loved watching it. But you know, as I say, if you stood back and. If we had the Sky Plus at the time where we could play back what they were saying, the North Platter was nonsense. And but it was
Twitter,
great
if
TV.
Twitter was there.
Or if Twitter was there, indeed. Like they pull you up on, and maybe you've just touched something there that people are very much aware that the Twitterati out there, I mean, I had to come off it in the end. I'm off it nearly a year now. Because they're just savage. I mean, if you were, I don't know what sort of you'd want the mental
fortitude
of a marine out in Afghanistan or somewhere to put up with some of the stuff. And
so if you were having a look at hashtag Sunday game or hashtag Kevin McStay, it wasn't pretty.
I remember having a chat with Darren Maloney about 5 or 6 months ago. He was in the same boat. He said, no, it can't. It's such a drainer. You know, and I suppose what you learn is just like 50% will think you're doing a great job and 50% will just think you're absolutely useless. But I still think, and again, I would say this, I still think the Sunday game, it's an absolute institution, Joe. They have very, very high standards of production in there. I mean, the editorial meetings that we go to are very, very detailed. And they do want to be fair to people. I mean, that is one of the guiding principles. Maybe that's why people have lightened up a bit, that, you know, editors and production staff, they're just absolutely insistent that you're fair to people and that you just cannot say the things that I think you could say previously.
You can still say it about Kevin De Bruyne, but like Kevin De Bruyne is not sitting at home watching it and going to work the next day. Like it is that different sphere slightly, you know?
Yeah. I know it's we're dealing with a game, our national game, remember. And mammy and daddy are at home listening to what I'm saying about Joe. I remember once I called a guy the wrong first name maybe twice or three times in the commentary. just got into my head that his name was Pat when his name was Peter. And his mother was devastated.
Sacrilege.
Yeah. And small things like that, that everybody feels they own the Sunday game, that they have, they like their dollars are going into it. And they're, you know, they came up with this idea 40 years ago and they kept it going over the years. And that's brilliant. I think that's fantastic. But I still think the Sunday game, there's enough people manning it and contributing to it that makes it still a very good show. I think it's a must watch for most people. If I'm not on the show, I know I'm driving back from a game. I'm always trying to be back in time to catch it because you just don't know what's going to come up on it or what angle they're going to go after. And I'm very, very pleased to have been involved with it for so long. And let's see where that goes.
Yeah, good man. Listen, really enjoyed this chat. It was so enjoyable. Kevin McStay, absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. I really liked chatting to you. Thanks very much.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.